The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We shape our dwellings, and afterwards, our dwellings shape us. Winston Churchill said that in 1944, and it remains true today. As part of our station-wide series, The First Decade, we're looking at how the environmental and familial circumstances of a child's first 10 years can influence, even determine, their later lives. Today, housing, neighborhoods, and the built environment.
We know that poor health stems from your environment in many ways, and unfortunately a lot of poor quality housing throughout the United States has been impacting health. And what we see is that it's primarily impacting young children and older seniors who are more susceptible to poor indoor air quality.
That's Jamie Blosser, founder of the Sustainable Native Communities Collaborative and associate at Atkin Olson Shade, echoing findings from a spate of recent studies that have quantified how childhood poverty, specifically living in a poor neighborhood, influences cognitive abilities, adult employment, earnings, and behavioral and health problems, including depression, asthma, diabetes, and heart disease, at higher than average rates. We reach Jamie Blosser and Kathy Dorgan, two prominent practitioners of community and public interest design, last week, just after they'd put together a panel on community-based design at the American Institute of Architects Conference in Atlanta. Here's Jamie talking about some of that panel's findings.
One of the data points is that 20 to 30% of asthma attacks are linked to home conditions that can be avoided. The other thing that we try to promote is activity. So it's not just indoor air quality. It's getting people to be outside more, to be walking around more. For instance, climbing 3 to 4 floors per day is associated with a reduced stroke risk of 29%. We're sort of on the tip of this sort of metrics that will change a lot of what we do.
Practitioners now use the term affordable housing to distinguish their work from the low-income housing units of the past. Those projects have mostly been torn down to establish more human-scale structures. Still, being raised in poor housing in a low-income area can directly affect a person's opportunities. Here's Kathy Dorgan, an architect and urban planner who employs participatory design practices, which she says can achieve communities of choice and justice.
There are so many examples of that. There's a recent study out of Harvard that really looked at where children live and what kind of opportunities come their way as a basis of where they live. And so, for example, if someone lived, perhaps one of your nephews, in New Hampshire in an average community, opportunity, and they moved to Baltimore, which has recently been in the news, which is not an area of high opportunity, their long-term prospects for the household income would decrease for a boy by 1.39% for every year that they lived in Baltimore. And so the lifetime effect of that would be, if someone lived there their whole childhood, they might make a third of what they would make if they'd stayed in a community of average opportunity.
But that does not only happen in inner cities like Baltimore, says Jamie.
When we look at poverty, 85% of counties in the United States that are high poverty counties are non-metropolitan. So we know that rural poverty is a huge issue. And unfortunately, with more information and more data about location and how important location is in affordable housing and providing access to transit and employment and services, we know that rural regions are even more vulnerable because they are more remote and do not have that access. So we see higher costs of living, but we also see higher vulnerabilities, I think, without that access.
A study from the Urban Institute looking at low-income residents in Chicago and Portland found even preteen kids at risk of experiencing school failure, engaging in risky sexual activity, and suffering from poor mental health. While the numbers may sound bleak, not all low-income communities are dead ends. There are places known as opportunity-rich or high-opportunity communities, characterized by more stability and supervision for children, and better schools and access to transportation. Here's Kathy Dorgan.
High opportunities often are high-income communities, but they're not always. So we have a great variance between communities with similar income profiles and the amount of opportunity that they afford to the residents. And there's a lot of things that lead to that. A lot of it's trust. There's been a lot of studies of communities that work together better, trust each other, provide more opportunity for all of their residents, high or low income, communities with less segregation. But it's also a matter of public policy. And we've seen great examples in Massachusetts where they've moved to much higher performing schools in many low-income communities, and that's, of course, immediately made those higher opportunity communities. I live in Connecticut, where we have much more disparate and the highest in the nation difference in income in achievement between communities. So that difference in achievement in communities in Connecticut makes it a much worse place for a poorer person or anyone to live than our neighboring state of Massachusetts that's addressed that by policy.
As practitioners of community and public interest design, Jamie Blosser and Kathy Dorgan aim to bridge that gap. Here's Kathy again.
So the important thing, I think, here is to provide every resident with opportunities and access to those opportunities. And there's a lot of ways to achieve that, and that may be by mixing incomes within a specific development. It may be by mixing incomes and opportunities and resources within a larger neighborhood. And so I think it's every community has important structures and resources for providing opportunity, and it's therefore important to do real design within communities to understand the existing conditions, to understand the opportunities there. Having said that, I think it's really important not to have large areas of segregated incomes and segregated opportunity.
Not segregating communities based on incomes or race, a lesson learned perhaps by the public housing fails of the post-war era. Think of those massive urban high-rises isolated on the outskirts of cities, places like the infamous Pruitt-Igoe housing project in St. Louis, built with great promise in 1956, only to be demolished in the mid-1970s, or the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago, widely considered to be a low point for American urban renewal. While it's easy enough to see those failures in hindsight, will today's designers make similar mistakes? Nadia Anderson is an associate professor of architecture and urban design at Iowa State University. I asked her about the public housing of the post-war era. What did those planners and architects get wrong?
One of the big issues is the move away from integrated neighborhoods that were smaller scale and had services, housing, small businesses, schools, all within walking distance of each other, to housing-only large concentrations of people without jobs, grocery stores, good transportation, anything like that nearby. And so the high-rise model basically follows that. Another issue was that a lot of the government housing, particularly in the United States, because of budget constraints, was made with not very good materials, often had issues with maintenance.
Mm-hmm. In what ways did the designs fail to serve the community? And I'm thinking specifically about children.
One of the things is obviously that the high-rise, while it's an idea of a tower in a park, by moving people off of 1 to 3 stories where they have easy pedestrian access to the space of the street and the space of the outdoors. When you go to a 10, 20, 30-story building, you start to move people away from the ground, away from places for play and interaction that you get typically on a street or in a small pocket park in a more traditional neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So there may have been greens and grounds and playgrounds in these places, but did people use them?
I think that really varies. I think over time, definitely not, particularly as safety issues started to mount, where you had elevators that weren't maintained and, you know, staircases that became dangerous to go up and down. And so, you know, people would only use them really when they had to. And the same is true now in a lot of neighborhoods that are struggling with poverty issues, where kids are kept indoors because of safety.
Well, Nadia, you specialize in public interest design. Now, what is that exactly?
Public interest design is really about designers working, not providing expert professional advice to a passive public, but it's really about partnership with public organizations, communities, nonprofits, government institutions that typically don't have access to traditional design services, and the engaged partnership with those communities is really critical, because as professionals, we come in with certain technical and other design skills and knowledge, but the people who live in the places where we're hoping to work have knowledge of place, of history, and of what their community really needs. And so it's an equal partnership.
Sounds like it's not top-down, but involves the community. So how does that actually work? Do you meet with members of the community? How do you select them? How do decisions get made?
Well, we usually try to start at a more general level, where we're trying to identify what are key issues within a community. And even if we're talking about a very specific, you know, product, let's say a plaza as part of a streetscape design, we'll talk as much about how people imagine themselves using the space and what they can envision happening there as we will about specific materials. And I think material kinds of decisions really come fairly late in the process, and they naturally tend to evolve out of the discussions that have preceded them.
One of the criticisms of housing projects, traditional housing projects that we've seen, is that they are unsightly, not an interesting place to live, I would say, outside of the projects that were destroyed in New Orleans. How important is beauty when it comes to affordable housing?
I think beauty is really important, and it gives people a sense of respect for themselves and for their own communities. Now, you know, everyone has a different definition of beauty, but one of the things that I've seen that's very important in designing affordable housing is that, you know, the place where someone lives represents who they are, what their community is, and what their values are. And that's one of the biggest contributions that I think well-designed buildings can make to a sense of identity for both individuals and communities.
Well, when we're looking at affordable housing, in what ways can good design help people cope with low-income lives or alleviate their financial strain or some of the concerns particular to them?
You know, I think there are some really simple things, like having spaces that are well laid out. I remember one of the first projects that I worked on with students. There were complaints from residents that they couldn't watch their kids from the kitchen. So making sure that the kitchen opened into the living room so that everybody, you know, could be within eyeshot of each other and also be able to engage in conversation. Other things like making sure that money gets spent in the budget on good quality windows, building envelope insulation in order to make the buildings as energy efficient as possible really helps to reduce utility costs, which can be a really big part of housing costs.
Affordable housing is also a concern in rural areas. What should a designer consider when developing affordable housing in those kind of areas?
That is a really good question, and I have some experience with that, being from Iowa. One of the big challenges with affordable housing in rural areas is cost effectiveness, and it's very difficult when you're in a rural area where an old ramshackle house can be acquired for, say, $40,000, and a new construction is going to be $120,000 to ever get close to an affordable cost. the idea of rehabilitation of existing housing stock, I think, is one of the biggest challenges facing rural communities right now.
Well, Nadia Anderson, thank you for filling us in.
You're welcome.
Nadia Anderson, she's Associate Professor of Architecture and Urban Design at Iowa State University, and she co-directs the university's Community Design Lab.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's been a lot of reporting that frames cash-checking stores and payday lenders as predatory businesses, and that may be true, but as Roman Mars of 99% Invisible points out, the people who run these businesses are very smart about how they design those spaces and suggest that conventional banks might benefit by doing the same.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
Keeping money in a savings account where it earns interest is logical.
Let's pretend you've never been to a bank before. Douglas McGray is going to be our guide.
You walk through the door, you see the red carpeting, you see someone in a suit there maybe greeting you, you see some ferns, you know, a nice row of professional-looking people in suits behind the counter.
You don't really see what it is they offer.
Chances are if you walk into the bank, you look around, you're not going to see a lot of services or prices. You have to kind of know what you want going in there.
Or you have to talk with someone to help you figure it out.
If you think about it, almost like it's like if you went to a restaurant and there's no menu on the door and you walk inside and like instead of giving you a menu, they ask sort of, what do you want? And you go, Italian? And then you have a conversation about what they could provide and the 17 different sauces they could offer and all the different shapes of pasta. A reasonable person might think like it'd be kind of nice to have a menu.
Doug McGray is a journalist.
My name is Douglas McGray. I'm a fellow at the New America Foundation, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Pop-Up Magazine.
And a couple of years ago, he wrote a story about check cashers and payday lenders, which McGray is quick to point out these are different services. Check cashing is when you have a check, it's made out to you.
You go in with a check, you leave with cash.
Minus a 3% fee or so. And payday lending is when you don't have any money. So you write the payday lender a check.
For $350 and you get $300 and they cash it in 2 weeks.
Those are the much more problematic transactions if you happen to think charging 400% interest is bad for the working poor. But McRae found that for better or worse,
you know, I think it's mostly for worse,
these places are here to stay. What may surprise you, though, if you have the same visceral reaction that I used to have to them,
if it's a person who's used to going to banks, they're going to think they're a little bit grimy,
is that these check cashing stores, even with their problems,
the fees are too high. I can't say that enough. You know, the fees are, most of them are too high.
May teach banks something about using design to better serve a wider range of customers. The absence of the bank-like trappings, plush carpeting, ferns, big desks, suits, they're missing for a reason. When Doug McRae went on a tour of a branch with Tom Nix, who at the time was the owner of the largest chain of check cashing stores in Southern California, Nix pointed out the design choices he made.
You know, he pointed out the linoleum floor. And he said, you know, if you go into a bank, you're going to see a carpeted floor. And say a guy is coming off of his construction shift, he's in his work boots. If he walks across the carpeted floor, he's going to feel like a jerk. I don't know if he's right or wrong, but it was an interesting point. And it was a conscious choice. You know, they would not put down carpeting.
Nix also worked really hard to make his places seem just like retail.
It reminds me a lot of a corner store, only instead of selling chips and soda and stuff like that, it's financial services.
And everyone patronizes and is welcome at a corner store, rich and poor. And you know what everything costs.
One of the most important things, maybe the most important thing, at this chain of check cashers, and you'll see this at a lot of them, there was a big list of prices on the wall. And it was all really straightforward. And the prices were, for the most part, the prices were too high. But you weren't going to wonder what something was going to cost. You weren't going to wonder what they could do for you. And when I talked to people who chose to go to check cashers, a lot of them had had a bank at one point. They signed up for some free checking account, but then all of a sudden they had these fees and they would like read these statements that were pages long and they couldn't figure out why they were getting charged what they were getting charged.
Plus, you aren't paralyzed by the vast number of options available to you.
If you go to your bank, chances are, you know, they'll have like 5 different savings accounts. They'll have 5 different checking accounts. They'll have all these investment accounts. They'll have college savings accounts. You know, it's a research project. It's hard to figure out which one is right for you.
And I, for one, always seem to leave with the feeling that I picked the wrong one.
The check cashers and payday lenders, they'll have a bunch of different services, but there will only be one of each. So you can cash your checks and it costs this much. You can wire money to your family in another country, and it costs this much. It's all designed to be really simple.
Let's pretend you've never been to a bank before.
I think some banks are realizing that their cookie-cutter suburban branch, you know, they can't drop it down and have it work everywhere. You know, it's one thing if you opened a bank account with your parents when you were 8 years old and you've been going there forever, and all the weirdness of a bank, the no prices and the pamphlets and the ferns, like all the stuff that's kind of strange about a bank when you think about it, it's just normal because that's what a bank is. Well, if you don't know what a bank is, if it's not normal, then maybe it's weird.
And that piece was produced by Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2012 was a tough one for comedian Tig Notaro. She was in and out of the hospital with an intestinal infection. Her mother died suddenly. She broke up with her longtime girlfriend. And the kicker, she was diagnosed with cancer. On August 3rd, she walked onto the stage for her regular gig at Largo in Los Angeles and began her act.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi. How are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? Ah, it's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer.
And with that startlingly personal admission, her career took off. A documentary team filmed her undergoing treatment for stage 2 breast cancer. Now 44, after a double mastectomy, she's back on the road, out with a new TV special, writing a memoir, and on her way to the Hop at Dartmouth on Wednesday. Tig Notaro, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Knock Knock. It's Tig Notaro, which premiered on Showtime last month. So the premise is that people send in submissions for you to come and perform in their hometowns or even their homes or backyards. You got more than 1,000 submissions. How did you decide where to go?
Well, I've done the tour previously, and this was the first time it was filmed for release in any way. And the way I've always done it is just to have an idea of a route that I want to go on and then take all submissions and then really focus on the area that I have in mind, but then kind of allow myself the freedom to go to a different town or veer outside of the tour that I've scheduled beforehand.
So you did go to southern Indiana. You go to Pluto, Mississippi. Now, you were born in Mississippi, I guess, and raised outside of Houston, yeah?
Yeah, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi, and then we moved down to the Gulf Coast to Pass Christian, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Spring, Texas, which is a smaller town outside of Houston.
Yeah, you dropped out of high school. Did you know then you wanted to be a comedian?
No, I pretty much just knew I did not want to be in school. I failed 3 grades and dropped out. And I mean, I was definitely the mischievous class clown in school, but I didn't really know. I loved stand-up as a kid, and I followed it and listened to records and stuff, but I just I didn't know for sure, I think, until I was in my early 20s.
Well, I guess you were kind of doing your bit or establishing your bona fides because a lot of comedians began as miscreants, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I always, whenever I'm hanging out with my friends in Los Angeles, I always refer to everyone as the land of misfit toys from, you know, those claymation shows.
Right. From the Santa Claus
Christmas.
Is coming
yeah,
to town.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the appeal for you as a performer playing to these little stages? I mean, I thought that once you get big, you don't perform for 9 people anymore.
Well, I appreciate that you think I'm big. I don't know. I think there's comedy is always great in awkward and unsafe environments. And I think that that's kind of a way that you can get back to that, because walking into a comedy club when you're when you're a known comedian or you have a very worked out show, it is a pretty safe ride. But when you are working out new material or you have no material, which is what happened to me on that tour, I had no new material. I relied on a few old jokes in that taping, but in general, I was trying to get my feet wet again after having old material and then announcing that I had cancer in this show a couple of years ago. And then it kind of cleaned my slate with material where when I got back out, I was like, God, I really don't have anything. And so it puts you into that unsafe, exciting environment, being in someone's living room.
It sounds terrifying to me.
It is. Trust me.
And
but
awkward.
It's also exhilarating.
Yeah, is it? So do you feel like you've come away from that experience with what?
I can't wait to do it again.
Really?
Yeah. I hope it turns into a TV show down the road.
But you used to be known anyway as a deadpan comic, not offering a lot of clues about who you are. And then this, after initially announcing that you had cancer at that show at Largo.
Oh, my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation. Oh, it's fine. Here's what happened. It's very personal. Found a lump. Guys, relax. Everything's fine. I have cancer.
I'm thinking of those hours beforehand. I mean, did you decide you were going to do this? Did you rehearse it? What happened?
Well, I had several days. I was diagnosed on July 25th, and the show was August 3rd. And so I spent those days just reflecting on how I felt. And I had originally wanted to cancel the show, but the owner of the club suggested I just keep the show and see how I felt right up to the last second. And if I didn't want to do it, I could cancel. So I kept it on the books, and then I just kept writing and seeing how I felt. And I knew that I couldn't have, because aside from cancer, my mother died unexpectedly after an accident, and I was in the middle of a breakup, and I had another illness where I couldn't eat food. I was really at rock bottom. And so I could not bring myself to get on stage with a cancer diagnosis and, you know, a skeletal frame of a body and just be like, oh, my gosh. So I was traveling the other day, you know, and just make lighthearted jokes. I felt like I had something massive staring me in the face and I needed to acknowledge it and hopefully make light of it. And yeah, it wasn't my typical style, but before I walked on stage, I was so nervous because I knew I was about to do something I had never done and that I had no clue how it was going to go. And, so the safety was definitely gone there.
He made huge news. Louis C.K., among others, praised your set. He said it was one of the few truly masterful sets he'd ever seen. People talk about you on stage. I'm wondering what you saw in the audience as you were looking out.
I mean, it was such a mix of confused people waiting for the punchline, and just shock and awkward laughter. And then the more I kept talking about things, the more it became clear that it wasn't a joke. It was just really a setup of, you know, truth so that I could explore all the different aspects of what I was going through and make light of it. And once people started to realize it was true, I also saw people crying in the audience. And it was really a mixed bag to look out into. And it was also a reality check, letting me know that this is really happening. It was kind of hard to comprehend everything. Very surreal moments that I would go in and out of.
And now when you hear those clips of you doing that, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you feel like...
Oh. I don't listen to those clips. I mean, honestly, if somebody's playing it in an interview or... And it's not just from that show that it's hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to anything of myself. I really can't think of anything worse than hearing myself. And it's not like, oh, that this is such a hard time and painful time. It's just, oh, my gosh, I can't hear myself. I used to listen to myself when I was first starting out as a stand-up, and I would record all my shows. And even now when I'm working out new material, I'll sometimes record the audio. But I always think it's a funny sight if somebody walked in and heard me listening to my audio, because I'm telling jokes. You hear the audience laughing, and my face is very stoic and serious listening. My face does not look like I understand comedy at all when I'm listening very intently.
The comedian Tig Notaro is with us. She is going to be performing at the Hop at Dartmouth on Wednesday. She's also going to be taping a live HBO special at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on May the 31st. Do people now who have cancer seek you out? I mean, do they think you're kind of the cancer comic, the one who's been through it?
I don't know what people think, but I certainly get quite the mix of people at my shows, from podcast fans that listen to my podcast, comedy nerds, and cancer survivors, and just every person across the board. And it's really an interesting mix of people. People that just had a bad day and listened to my show from 2012, had a bad day at the office, and they're like, wow, that really put things into perspective for me. And so I don't know what brings people to me, but I know it seems to be, you know, from casting a wide net through all the different avenues I've taken along the way.
How are you doing now? How's your health?
I always say, as far as I know, it's really good. I'm actually going to my oncologist in a couple hours, and I'm 3 years of no evidence of disease.
Wow.
Which is
hooray.
Terrific.
People who cheat death often have an air of invincibility. How about you? Did it embolden you to try new things? I mean, you're writing a memoir now. There is just a documentary about you, this television documentary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I've always tried new things, and I've gone out on a limb, and I think I didn't realize that until I saw the completed documentary about my life. It's supposed to be coming out this summer.
And right, this called- is Tig?
Yeah, it's called Tig. And after I watched the movie, I was like, wow, I take chances. Mm. And I take serious risks. And I didn't realize that about my personality. But I think more than risks that are gigantic, I think cheating death makes me more of somebody more open to be celebrating daily things and anniversaries, birthdays, just any celebratory moment. Or I was writing about this in my book yesterday, about how as a child I got soaps, a little box of soaps that were in the shape of combs and brushes and mirrors, and they seemed too special to ever use. And so I never used them. And then I don't ever know where they went. And I was just reflecting on how I should have just, the day I got them when I was 5, I should have gotten in the bathtub and used them. And I think there's more of that feeling of, I'm going to use the soaps that come in the shape of a hand brush or a mirror, you know.
You know, I've heard this expression, it's not what happens to you, it's what you do with it. And I couldn't help but think that, listening to the tape of you talking about having cancer after this year of unbelievable shock and grief.
Four months. Yeah.
Compact time of shock and grief and ill health. But looking back at it, I mean, would you do this any differently? Would you have treated that? Would you have kept it private?
No. I was already private. And this is what blew the doors off of privacy and making me realize that it helped me to communicate. It helps every situation to be open and vulnerable and communicative, and every door opened in my personal life, my love life, my career, my family, my friends. There's rarely any time in life where you withhold and really see a payoff.
Tig Notaro, thank you so much. I'm really glad you're on your way to New Hampshire.
I can't wait to be there. So thanks for your time.
Tig Notaro, she's a stand-up comedian. She's got a memoir in the works for 2016, a documentary film called Tig, and a documentary on Showtime. And she's going to be at the Hop at Dartmouth on Wednesday. She's taping a live HBO special at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on May 31st. You'll find details on all of it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The specter of cancer looms large in our minds, and yet tumors themselves remain largely invisible to the people who have them. Producer Eric Malinsky brings us the story of an artist who sought to better understand her disease by turning an intangible diagnosis into physical art.
In 2008, Leonore Caraballo was diagnosed with breast cancer. From the moment the doctor said the word cancer, everything was a blur.
I realized a year later, after I went through the whole cancer management, that I had no idea what they were talking about. I hadn't seen this tumor. I knew it wanted to kill me, but I didn't really understand what it meant.
Now, Leonore is an artist. She needs to process things visually. So she asked the radiologist to give her pictures of the MRI scans. Each scan is a different cross-section of the tumor, like a slice of cake.
You know, there's thousands of slices. So I just looked at each and every one, different angles. And I kept on wanting to see it. I wanted to see it as an object. I wanted to take it basically out of the breast. I wanted to do what the surgeon did with the double mastectomy. I wanted to do that artistically.
She wanted to build a 3D model of her tumor, something she could hold in her hands. The first step was to create a 3D model on the computer, and then a 3D printer would take that blueprint and build a plastic model. It wasn't easy.
The MRI images everything, right? So all the tissue, all the vessels, and the tumor is kind of there with a slightly different shading.
Abu Farman is Leonore's husband and creative partner.
The 3D printer can't print everything. First of all, it'll just go nuts. So it either do surface.
And it would take 3 months to
print. We don't want to just print the surface of a breast. So the first thing was, digitally, how do you just isolate that thing?
And once they isolated that thing in the computer, the 3D printer was like, I can't print this thing. I mean, you know, if the printer could talk. The tumor was a weird blobby shape with very thin tentacles shooting outward. The artist had to work very closely with a computer technician.
We were, you know, in a way using this extremely high-tech process and then taking it all the way back to
the Bronze Age.
Back to the Bronze
Age. Lost wax and Bronze Age.
Actually, they took it to a foundry in Queens where the plastic model was cast in bronze. Now Leonore wears a little bronze tumor around her neck.
For me, it's a reminder that I hate the word survivor, but that I'm here and this thing is out of my body. And, you know, and I feel more powerful than it.
It means it stopped growing. Okay, that's how it was. That's the final form
it took.
That's how
it was removed, and it's this final form it took, and it's not going to move anymore. It's not going to spread.
But they wanted to make more. So Michelle Drotman, a radiologist at Cornell Medical Center, gave them MRI scans of tumors from different women.
It's just amazing how different it looks outside the breast.
And how different the tumors look from each other. Some look like rock candy, others look like a piece of coral or a meteorite.
And that's what cancers usually are. They're not these nice, smooth lesions. They're ugly.
They're aggressive by nature.
Cancers don't follow tissue planes like benign things, which kind of respect the tissue. Tumors just grow, you know, wherever they want.
The couple created a company called Object Breast Cancer. Women can order paperweights, amulets, or worry beads based on their own MRI scans. Or they can order sculptures based on tumors from anonymous women. One of their first customers was Paula de la Cruz. She still cringes when she thinks about the moment the nurse gave her the results.
She handed me the paper and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for the bad news." I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea.
She turned to her friend, Leonor Caraballo, who recommended a surgeon and a radiologist. And then eventually, Leonor sculpted a paperweight based on Paula's tumor. Now Paula's in remission, but she likes having a physical reminder that sits on a stack of bills.
When I was going through the whole healing process, you know, chemotherapy, etc., you know, people use this war, you know, tones like, you gotta beat this, blah, blah. And I always felt it's my body that's chaotic and that's making these cells that are out of control. I mean, how are you at war with your own body?
You're monumentalizing illness.
I talked with the art critic Patty Johnson. She's a blogger who writes for Art Review and Art in America.
I think if you believe that, like, making this thing into a solid object that doesn't move is going to empower you, then obviously, yes, it is empowering. Would I feel that way? No.
Artwork that deals with illness, like AIDS or cancer, can put critics in a very difficult position.
I feel like I'm being a jerk right now, and that doesn't feel good. I mean, you asked me to talk about, like, to bring my background and my knowledge to this, and so that's what I have to do. It's part of my job.
Now, typically, art that deals with illness is fairly abstract. Now, this work is painstakingly literal, which is why Patty Johnson doesn't like it.
From a fine art perspective, we would look at the narrative that this work produces, and we would look at the metaphors, and we would say, you know, these metaphors are really obvious. They're a little too concrete. You know, I do wish that it looked a little more dangerous, something that looked otherworldly and a little less like things we already know.
Like a piece of coral or a rock formation.
Then it falls into another genre of art that I like to call invisible history art. So that's when the object doesn't speak to you until you're aware of the backstory.
But that backstory made the sculptures really interesting for Dr. Alexander Swistel. He removed the tumors from Leonor Caraballo and Paula de la Cruz. And then suddenly there they were, scaled up, cast in bronze, and sitting in an art gallery.
To actually see it in front of you, and then to actually pick up the sculpture and run your fingers over it and just understand, this is something that I took out. As a surgeon, it was a huge surprise.
Remember the tentacles and the tumors that made it so hard for the artist to build 3D models? Well, in real life, they were misleading Dr. Swistel. They were making him think that the tumors were actually bigger than they were.
We kind of thought to ourselves, well, wait a minute. So maybe we've been going at the treatment all wrong.
So as part of an experiment, he's working with a radiologist, Michelle Drotman, to create 3D models of tumors in the computer, just like the artists. The doctors are going to decide how much radiation to give patients based on the volume of their tumors, not just the widest dimensions.
Making therapeutic decisions based on three-dimensional volume measurements has just never been, to my knowledge, done at all in any kind of setting of any kind of tumor, but certainly for breast cancer.
And clinical trials are underway. He predicts that some of his patients may end up getting less chemotherapy, and maybe none at all.
And that story was produced by Eric Malinsky. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.